You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
So this panel, while one could argue that it was inspired by Biggie Smalls with the more services, more domains riff, it's really about unmanned systems and what is truly a killer application in both meanings of the term, a disruptive technology, but also one that's proven to be incredibly useful on and off the battlefield. The U.S. military, for example, went into Iraq with a handful of robotic systems, unmanned aerial vehicles, remotely piloted aircraft, drones, whatever you want to call them, we went in with a handful. Today, there's more than 8,000 in the U.S. military inventory in the air, and on the ground, there's another 12,000. And this technology has certainly gone global, with at least 87 other countries' militaries now utilizing unmanned aerial systems, as well as a looming civilian boom in everything from domestic drones to robotic cars. It's an exciting time, but as this technology advances, though, we face a series of tough questions. And today we have three officers who have tackled an array of these issues in what one writer called a robotics revolution out there. So first we'll hear from Commander Tom King, who joined the FEF program after 21 years of service with the Coast Guard, having recently come off assignment as budget and program reviewer at the Office of Budget Programs at Coast Guard headquarters. Then we'll hear from our international security fellow, Colonel Abba Shirai, who's with the Japanese Air Self-Defense Force. He is a senior pilot, most recently with F-15s, and served as supervisor of Defense Policies and Programs Division at the Air Staff Office at the Japanese Ministry of Defense. And then we'll hear from Commander Rob DeBuse with the U.S. Navy. He's an explosive ordnance warfare officer and joined Brookings after serving as the head of the Navy's Expeditionary Requirements Branch on the CNO's staff. Tom?
Thank you, Peter, and thank you, everyone, for staying this afternoon for this presentation. As Peter mentioned, my last tour was as a program reviewer in our budget formulation, which sparked an interest as I came here to look at different acquisition processes within the Department of Homeland Security. As we all know, the budget seasons are tight here. So I decided to conduct the research into the Department of Homeland Security's acquisition efforts in unmanned aerial systems, specifically within two of their components, the Customs Border Protection Agency and the Coast Guard. And for the sake of this presentation, when I speak of UAS, I'm referring to a system consisting of a remotely piloted aircraft, ground control station, ground data terminal, and the data and voice communications, so the whole system itself. So since 2004, UAS has been used to support the Homeland Security missions, while the acquisition and utilization of UAS and Homeland Security efforts has received favorable congressional support. DHS's oversight and acquisition efforts have been the subject of numerous studies and reports into the efficiency and effectiveness of their processes and their projects. One GAO report had indicated that DHS made investment decisions on a program-by-program and a component-by-component basis, did not have a process to systematically prioritize its major investments. So starting off with the Customs and Border Protection Agency, their UAS acquisition consisted of the land-based Predator B UAS, which supported their law enforcement and homeland security missions along the nation's borders. The Predator B was selected for a unique combination of operational capabilities, payload capacity, mission flexibility, potential to accommodate new sensor packages, and its safety and performance record. At the time of its acquisition, it was one of the few UASs able to qualify for the FAA certificate waiver and authorization to operate within the national airspace. DHS approved the UAS program as a component of the Customs and Border Protection Strategic Air and Marine Plan and authorized the agency to acquire up to 24 complete systems. For the Coast Guard's acquisition of UAS, they focus mostly on technologically mature systems, commonality with DHS and DOD, and leveraging other agencies' UAS experience. They've been active investigating options for both land-based and ship-based UAS. Now, for their land-based UAS, they sought to utilize custom border protections, Predator B, and in fact, that was some of them have been modified for a maritime variant called the Guardian, and they utilize that land-based UAS through a joint program office that coordinates those efforts. And since 2007, the Coast Guard has partnered with the Navy to develop and field the Fire Scout UAS aboard the Coast Guard's national security cutters. This effort still continues, however, it's been slowed down a bit due to technological difficulties and the Navy's operational needs. So as an alternative to a ship-based UAS system, the Coast Guard looked at a smaller version of a UAS to provide that surveillance capability for their offshore cutter fleet. And they're working with the Department of Navy's technology transfer program to assist in those capabilities and are fielding a test model now, as undergoing those test options now. So going through all the literature review and conducting some interviews, looked at coming up with some preliminary conclusions, findings, and recommendations. And basically, the first one is DHS is going just through the standard, I don't want to say standard, but going through the acquisition learning curve here. They hadn't adequately, specifically Customs Border Protection, hadn't adequately planned resources needed to support its unmanned aircraft inventory. They experienced some of the same logistical issues that DOD did with training, mission support, and communication infrastructure issues. CPB, their Office of Air Marine, has minimal research and development staff, and so they relied on leveraging some of the DOD technology staff and some of their efforts in looking at implementing their UAS. Second, the acquisition choices done by DHS to include the Coast Guard and Customs Border Protection Agency, those are being evaluated and adapted. On the land base, as mentioned, the Predator B was the UAS of choice, and they moved out on acquisition of that asset, and they weren't prepared for the full implementation of that asset. But they've acknowledged that. DHS and Customs have acknowledged that, and they're working with the current inventory and have suspended purchasing and acquiring more assets. Ship-based, the Coast Guard continues to work with other agencies to develop the UAS that meets their operational requirements and prior to moving out on acquiring a system. And the acquisition of that small UAS as an interim acquisition strategy was approved by DHS and was thought out in logical progression as they wait for the final capability before acquiring it. Third, the management and oversight progress is being made by DHS. DHS has issued an acquisition management directive that contains oversight review stepping points that need to go through and also requires the components to have test results and acquisition baselines. A lot of the acquisitions are authority are left to the components to do their own internal review, but this management directive has put down some departmental control points on those acquisitions. DHS also established an integrated investment lifecycle model, which is intended to improve the portfolio management by ensuring mission needs drive the investment decisions. They've also developed a capabilities and requirements council, which will assist in identifying and cross-cutting opportunities and common requirements among the DHS components and assist in those resource decisions. And as I said earlier, they have developed that joint program office for their land-based UAS that will assist in the coordination of land-based UAS operations and policy development. And finally, the DHS acquisitions, they may influence the state and local enforcement efforts. The Customs Border Protection's Office of Air Marine, they deploy the largest law enforcement air force in the world, which would logically influence, in my opinion, other federal, state, and local law enforcement's acquisition strategies. Because I would assume that maybe those states would have a less research and development than even the Customs and Border Protection Agency would, and they would look at proven systems. Domestically, the state and local law enforcement agencies represent the greatest potential use of the small UAS in the near term, and the small UAS can offer a simple, cost-effective solution to some of their surveillance needs. And finally, the state and local agencies have already, some of them have already purchased UAS systems, and some of those have been done through grant programs from DHS. And there might be some room here for DHS to come up with a pre-selection list, a brand or approval list for small-time small versions of UAS, and also look at the acquisition efforts out as a collective unit if all these states and local agencies are purchasing the same models. So appreciate your attention and look forward to the questions.
Well, thanks so much for giving me this opportunity, and I'm very honored to be here at Brookings. The security environment of East Asia is uncertain and unstable. North Korea's nuclear program and missile development pose a serious and imminent threat to Japan's security. China is also rapidly expanding and intensifying its activities on the sea and in air. On December 13, 2012, Chinese aircraft violated Japan's air domain around Senkaku Island and detected by radar. As a result, the Ministry of Defense had to recognize there were some flaws which needed to be corrected in order to protect air sovereignty. So the Japanese Air Safety Defense Force, we call it JASAF, temporarily allocated E-2C airborne early warning aircraft to Naha Air Base in Okinawa. However, we are having difficulty covering the weak area because utilizing these aircraft 24/7 has led to increased equipment maintenance and fatigue. Under these circumstances, the new National Defense Program guidelines and the Midterm Defense Program were released at the end of the last year. The Ministry of Defense announced its decision to acquire three unmanned aerial vehicles in order to reinforce its ISR capability. However, many questions have arisen surrounding the incorporation of these new systems into the force structure, such as why do we need unmanned systems? Who should operate them? How do the new systems fit into existing command and control architectures? Unmanned aircraft systems must be useful in executing a 3D, danger daddy down missions. Regarding the Japan Self-Defense Force, I will say Japanese military. I think it is important to acquire UAVs for the prevention of the armed race and to replace the weaker aspect of human performance. Indeed, China has been rapidly advancing its military capabilities in a wide range of areas without sufficient transparency through its continued increase in military spending. But Japan should not try to catch up in this arms race. We are now confronted with PLA's strategy of exhaustion. Scrambling jet fighters against Chinese UAVs is exactly what they want us to do. For instance, the number of scrambles to the East China Sea used to be less than 40 times a year until 2009, but it jumped to about 300 times in 2013. The operational cost to fly an F-15 is about $20,000 per hour. So the JASA spent $24 million to scramble F-15s in 2013. The JASA will probably face pressure to reduce cost because we have to forge modernization programs, including acquisition of F-35. On the other hand, the JASA is striving to maintain readiness for these allied missions by focusing human resources on the East China Sea. Even if the JASA could increase its budget for personnel, it wouldn't solve the problem of human errors and the fatigue of aircraft, which might cause an unpredictable incident in the East China Sea. The Ministry of Defense has prepared a budget of $2 million for research of UAVs in field year 2014. Unfortunately, I've already heard there are many challenges among related sections and services, such as who is in charge of UAVs, who pays for their operational cost. According to this situation, I'd like to suggest three concepts relating to doctrine, leadership, and culture. First is doctrine, or operation concept. As far as I know, the JASF has not recognized the original doctrine is needed for homeland security because we are reaction force. And nevertheless, the security environment has changed, and we need to modernize our air power for the information age. It is important to enunciate in doctrine the need to adapt to increase missions without extra cost and overloads. When formulating UAV doctrine, we must include an operational concept for the future mission and alternative plans for delayed modernization program. Autonomous controlled UAV could compensate their lack of the conventional air power. History proves that thinking about how a weapon will be used before deciding what to buy is important. Success of incorporating UAVs into the Japanese military depends on how well the JASF trusts the doctrine. Next is leadership. In order to implement UAVs effectively, strong leadership with able knowledge of UAV capabilities and the proper future vision of war is needed. We can expect some kind of conflict between the new UAV community and the old conventional weapons community. It would appear concerning personnel management issues such as career path, promotion rate, and awards. Moreover, UAVs enable JASF leaders to realize command and control has changed by not only real-time accurate information, but also by high mission accomplishment rate. In addition, senior leaders need to learn how to maintain C2 over UAVs without demoting strategic leaders to tactical ones. We might need a new definition of airmanship. Last is culture. The JASF need to cultivate a new culture of UAVs. All JASF members should learn about UAVs and get rid of their prejudices against them. I expect implementing UAVs into the JASF will lead to enhanced synergy in each service and help create an effective joint operations mindset. I recommend the Japanese military should make a joint operations research team for UAVs in a Joint Chief of Staff, cooperate with Joint Unmanned Aircraft System Center of Excellence to learn from U.S. military expertise and enhance interoperability. The JASA should also expand UAV culture outside the organization in order to execute ISR mission efficiently with allied forces. NATO already has this kind of organization known as Joint Capability Group ISR and the UAV. Furthermore, Japan has been forced to deal with unilateral creation of the Chinese Air Defense Identification Zone as well. The JASA must take into consideration the need to avoid an unexpected accident, such as a mid-air collision. We need to establish a risk-averting mechanism as well. I believe that effort to set up the multilateral organization could be a method of solving sensitive incidents and improving it both allied force interoperability. Finally, UAVs are spreading in the world. The usefulness would be exponential in Asia because there were big gaps in air power between advanced countries and developing nations. The JASF needs to be aware that we are embarking on the journey into the information age. Incorporating UAVs into the JASF will be the first challenge as we adapt to this future. Thanks so much.
Good afternoon. My topic is how the United States Navy can use unmanned underwater vehicles to expand and maintain America's dominance of the underwater undersea domain. 1994, I was a lieutenant junior grade on board the USS Champion, operating off the coast of Corpus Christi. 200 yards away from us, a fishing vessel started taking on water and capsized. Not capsized, actually went end for end and went straight down. Six souls on board, four people made it out. Everybody was wearing their life preserver. The point is, I was on a minesweeper, USS Champion, MCM-4. It was fantastically equipped to go down and find that sunken boat. The boat sunk in about 2 minutes. The two people that were trapped on board, two souls that were trapped on board, we had to go find where they were at. So we used our mine hunting sonar, variable depth, and put a small radar reflector or sonar reflector in the water and walked it in and put it inside the boat. It's fantastic. Lesson learned there is this underwater exploration stuff and locating objects is simple. Piece of cake, no problem. What you need to be taken into account here is that this is right before GPS came about. The internet had been introduced about 3 years ago to the public, 3 years earlier to the public. And we had 26 minesweepers or mine hunters in the United States Navy inventory. The capacity problem, the negative takes away are we don't have that. There's only 26 total sonars that are out there. Finding that that vessel that sunk right in front of us was just happenstance. We do not have the United States Navy. No Navy has the presence to be everywhere at all times. That's why I think, and I think the Chief of Naval Operations and the commander of the submarine force are all putting their banking on trying to figure out a new way of dominating the undersea realm. And that includes putting unmanned undersea vehicles into greater use. Why is it important? Why do you care? The undersea realm is huge. It's for the most part, it's unexplored, it's unseen, and it's unseen and it's unexploited, and it's extremely important. You heard Dr. Kilcullen talk today about how everything is becoming more literalized. Everybody's moving towards the coast. 80% of the world's population lives within 50 kilometers of the coast. Additionally, 80% of the countries in the international community are maritime countries. They're all dependent upon those. All those countries are dependent upon maritime trade. 70% or greater than 70% of the Earth's surface is covered by water. The average depth of the oceans is 14,000 feet. The United States Navy's nominal operating depth for submarines is 800 feet. The United States Navy's nominal operating depth for U.S. Navy divers, of which I'm a proud member, is 300 feet. That means that 96% of the undersea domain is unexplored and untapped. And it's becoming a little bit more crowded in the battle space now because you've got commercial interests that are out there trying to figure out where we can find more oil and gas and mineral deposits, and you've got peer competitors like China trying to figure out how they can adapt to put submarines out to sea and use their vital resources in areas that are contested. So the best case is that 6% of the underwater volume is actually exploitable right now, unless we start using unmanned underwater systems. And this goes, again, back to what General Cardone was talking about when he talked about the interconnectedness of systems that are out there. Underwater cables right now provide 95% of all the international communications. So we're dependent on these things. Additionally, there's a significant amount of underwater, undersea oil and gas pipelines that are providing the energy for all of our cars and our gas and our oil explorations. It's not all coming from the sea, but a good significant quantity is coming from there. That's why it's important. We need to figure out a way of maintaining the free market system, and one way to do that is to make sure we've got the sea lanes of communication wide open and that it is open for use by all. There are problems, though, with going down and trying to exploit this domain. Air, ground, even cyber is a little bit less daunting because you can operate in that. We live there. For the most part, we don't live undersea. So we've got data. We've got significant problems with how we communicate, how we maintain long distance transit underwater. And I'm going to get into these in a minute. The unmanned undersea vehicle adoption by the United States Navy will still have the same types of barriers that we've been talking about with the unmanned air and ground systems. There's always going to be a culture bias. It's not the same manned system. It's not a manned submarine that goes down there and does this exploration. It's going to be a guy sitting in a terminal who programs usually an unmanned underwater vehicle to go out and do an exploration with a sensor. It's not as glamorous. It's not as cool as being a submariner back in the 1940s and 50s. Additionally, those same systems will be competing for dollars against these high-tech, exquisite systems that are manned. So an unmanned system, an unproven unmanned system, will have to compete against a proven system that was brought into bear about back in the 1950s. So those two problems I really acknowledge. But I think the biggest problem is, how do you get an unproven system to be proven? It's catch-22. You won't get the funding, you won't get the culture bias unless you can have the technology. You won't have the technology unless you have the culture and the funding behind it. So I think the best way to go at this is to attack the technological barriers and get a proven system. So let me define what the current largest technical barriers are for doing for implementing an unmanned undersea system program in the Navy. The first one is the requirement for an exquisite design. The Joint Capabilities Integration Development System, JCIDS, is the way that we go about acquiring systems in the Department of Defense. I think we've talked about it here with the Coast Guard. It's a very long and arduous process. It takes forever to get through. It may take years. In fact, the Littoral Combat System, Littoral Combat Ship, which has been under development for many years, is just now getting to sea. The point there is we try to put too many requirements on these systems to be able to meet a full range of mission opportunities, which reduces your ability to accept different techniques or different commercial applications and apply them or develop them. So it slows down the process and it actually frustrates the system. That's one barrier right now. Another barrier is data transmission underwater is very difficult. It's a very short range. It has been for a long period of time. It has to be within either connected using some sort of a tether from the surface or a very short range, very slow data transfer. Additionally, a third problem is propulsion. Propulsion problems come from lithium batteries as being the almost exclusive type of propulsion, with the exception of fuel cells, to try to get these unmanned underwater vehicles propelled throughout. And the problem there is they drain pretty quickly, especially when you start putting multiple sensors on there in your exquisite design that your JCIDS process has forced you to develop. Finally, there's a lack of a long-term vision. There is currently an unmanned systems roadmap for the Department of Defense. It mentions unmanned underwater vehicles twice in this 179-page document. So how do we get past that? My recommendations are to get past the exquisite design requirement is to stop doing that. We've used this in the last 12 years. We've taken lessons learned from programs like the Joint IED Defeat Organization, from options like the Joint Urgent Operational Needs Statements and OSD, the Office of Secretary of Defense Fast Lane projects, to speed along and accelerate technology for specific purposes. It's very simple to do that. All you've got to do is, in fact, we used this on one of the unmanned underwater vehicles that I was in charge of when I was back on the Navy staff. We were able to take an existing technology, accelerate it as fast as we could to put it against a very specific mission. We didn't have to go out and meet all the JCIDS requirements that were out there. We just had to get it down the road so we could start developing it. Additionally, we put it in the hands of users and operators so they could figure out exactly how to use this and come up with their own doctrine and their own organization for the program that will work much better with user input. Instead, you're going to, by the technical JCIDS documentation and the requirements, you'd build the program, you'd throw it at the fleet, and the fleet would figure out how to put it together. Now what you're doing with these faster programs like JIATO, JUONS, and the OSD Fastline initiatives are to push them forward, let the users develop it the way that they are implemented, and then you've got a better system. Finally, on the data transmission and the propulsion systems, the way to make that happen is to go out to academia, to the commercial industries, find out how they're doing it with their UUVs and their AUVs, and use that technology in that accelerated system to push out unmanned systems quicker and faster. I will tell you this is a very wide project. It has great strategic level application, but really at the operational tactical level, we've got to fix some of these problems before we can get to that strategic level vision for the unmanned systems.
Great. Three really interesting presentations that touched on, I think, both the globalization of the technology, but also how it's moving into lots of different domains and roles. Let me ask two questions. And the first is actually both for Tom and Rob. And what we have is an interesting shift going on, arguably, where, you know, if you look at the history of DHS buying them, as you mentioned, the really only option they had back in 2004 was they bought exactly what the DOD was using. They buy the Predator B. Now, however, we have a booming domestic drone industry. And so, you know, you mentioned, for example, the Coast Guard looking at how do we put a small UAS onto a cutter when tuna boats have been using the Scan Eagle for almost a decade versus, you know, oh, why should we buy Fire Scout if we've got this? And it's the same, arguably, we could look in when we look at UUVs. The oil and natural gas industry has been using them and has a much greater diversity of technologies than the Navy has in this space. So how do we essentially deal with the fact that we are, the challenge in robotics may be to spin in new technology rather than develop our own, and how do we do that better in this space? And then, Abba, the question for you is, as you've been doing your research, you've had the very interesting opportunity to look at it both from a Japanese perspective, but also to spend the year here in the U.S. and meet with a good number of U.S. military officers working in this space. So when you're looking at how Japan might approach this in the future, what parts of how the U.S. is using unmanned aerial systems and its doctrine, its organization, its personnel, do you think apply over to the Japanese experience? And where are there differences? Where are ways that Japan is unique and how we're doing it doesn't fit across? So why don't we go with you two first?
Great question. Thank you, Peter. And again, I didn't say it earlier, but thanks for having me here. I'm a completed fellow, by the way. Navy's so fast that we can do things twice as well as everybody else. The point you bring up is great. We have to figure out a way of getting the technology that's existing already in commercial industry infused quicker into the process. And I think that's one of the largest hurdles to get around is you cannot get the technology funded if it doesn't work. You can't fund it if it's not proven. So go out and take what's already on the shelf, put it into a faster system. And I actually had worked with the JIATO folks a lot, and we did do the OSD Fastlane process. We just went out and grabbed an off-the-shelf capability and put it through its paces as fast as possible. Now, there's problems with that because now once you've got a system that's proven, then you've got to go back and find out where the offset is, which is which one of your existing programs is going to give up money for the full development and fielding of that system. I like it. I think it's great, the stuff that we did, but it was such small scale. To get it on a larger scale to understand the unmanned systems dilemma, I think we've got to – it almost requires a – and I know we've done a little bit of revision on the defense acquisition program, but it almost requires a reliance on that because we are so far behind in some of the technologies that the military is able to put into their systems as compared to the commercial guys.
Thank you, Peter, for the question. I'll tack it one way on two different lenses. One with the Predator B, some backstory on that. Personalities matter within the Customs Border Protection. They did bring in some personnel from the Air Force that had familiarity with the Predator B. And it's not uncommon for DHS to get assets, whether the physical asset or technology, from DOD. There's a good history of that throughout both cutters within the Coast Guard, getting old Navy assets and utilizing them, or aircraft, whether it's the C-130s, the H-60s, or even the C-27s that are in the budget now to get. And given the size of the budgets, we're always have our hand out eagerly when someone is able to give us something. One of the other backstories, I think, with the Predator B selection was the congressional support. The support was kind of targeted in getting that way towards that avenue of forcing DHS to investigate and assess the UAS capability. As far as taking something off the shelf type thing, I think the small UAS is going down that way. It might have been a little bit late, as you say, with the tuna fleet, with the Scan Eagle. Scan Eagle is what they're testing out there, and some of that is some of the backstory with that acquisition of the UAS within the Coast Guard was the UAS was part of the Coast Guard's integrated deep water acquisition program that was started in the late 90s. However, that had some issues with it, and that was terminated. And then the Coast Guard took over the acquisition efforts. Previously, the concept was to go with a lead systems integrator that would acquire a system of systems. However, there were some issues with that acquisition philosophy, and that's been terminated. And as I said, the Coast Guard is looking at that, and then they're working with the Navy to look at that small UAS capability.
Right. Yeah. Thank you very much for a difficult question for me. So Japan, that's very difficult to explain because so we are not good at creating our own doctrine. So before the World War II, so the Japanese Imperial Navy emulated the Royal Navy. Then Army emulated Germany. Then we are emulating other foreign countries is our good talent of the Japanese people, I think. Then after Korean War, we were emulate United States military. So by constructing self-defense force, then maybe just a force structure must be just small of the U.S. Air Force. Then, so it's very easy to incorporate UAV into just by emulating United States Air Force. But, so before creating a doctrine, our attitude from so far, so but before creating a doctrine, we acquired some weapons. After that, so we're gonna make some how to use that weapon. But in that attitude to enhance our force structure, so there are a lot of the ways to create new weapons system or architectures. Then on February 5th, a senior Japanese and U.S. defense officials agreed to boost cooperation to cope with cyber attack at their first working group meeting on the cyber defense. Then Japan's Defense Force will send personnel to cooperate with the U.S. military to study and train against the cyber attack. Maybe so we will do same thing in regard to the unmanned system. So that's our perspective to create a new unmanned system. So I dare say we need the doctrine first. So we have to change that kind of the attitude.
Do you think that is the best decision to emulate the U.S. in this space, given on one hand you have the historic close relationship between JASDEF and U.S. Air Force? On the other hand, one could argue that the strategic situation that the Air Self-Defense Force is facing in terms of patrolling islands, surveilling at sea, dealing with scrambling threats is very different than how the U.S. Air Force developed UAS, which was looking primarily at how do I support troops on the ground in Afghanistan. Do you think that's the best path to follow, and are there modulations that might be made to reflect that?
Yeah, that's a good point. So we don't have that kind of doctrine. So we use the UAV just for the So enhancement of the ISR mission, but also we have no knowledge to operate UAV. So first of all, we have to learn about what is a UAV or something like that. So our force structure is very similar to the U.S. Air Force. So I can say that it's easy to cooperate and easy to make troops of the UAV. So we have no time to incorporate UAV into the JASA because East Asian security environment is very unstable. You argue. I understand what you want. What asked me, but so it's very difficult to explain about it.
Let's open up to the audience. And again, when the mic comes to you, please stand and introduce yourself. Right here in the front.
Hey, gang, how's it going? Ken Ekman. I'm a fellow. So each of you is talking about adopting a new capability that gives your respective agencies greater capacity, greater capability to perform a set mission. Now, it's kind of legendary that there are culture resistances to unmanned vehicles. But I think a corollary there is that unmanned for unmanned sake doesn't necessarily add value. So I was wondering, as you looked at material solutions for the mission spaces that you were trying to fill, how much inertia was there forcing you to go to an unmanned route where perhaps a manned system could have provided equal or greater value?
Thanks, Ken. For the Coast Guard, I'll speak specifically for the Coast Guard. The unmanned aerial system is really to augment our aircraft fleet and our air capability. We're not looking to replace it. We have it just for one specific set of surveillance. We still need all the other aircraft to conduct things that you actually need to deploy a rescue swimmer or to do those other Coast Guard missions. So there's not as much reluctance to incorporate UAS into that, into our culture and into our operations as I've seen in some of the other agencies.
Thanks, Ken. Appreciate it. The Navy is already moving in this direction, in particular on the mine warfare aspect. We have manned systems right now, the mine hunting and mine sweeping. The mine hunter class ships have already been decommissioned. We turned them over to we sold them on the market. So we're down from 26 ships. Now we're down to 14. Actually, we're down to 13 since one ran aground last year. So we really are looking at how we can increase the capacity of our current manned systems. I don't think it's ever going to be it may be in the long term a complete replacement for the manned systems, at least on the mine warfare side of the house. But right now it's just going to be an augmentation of that. The way to get out there and find the contacts and then go and prosecute them, that's probably as far as the mine warfare side of the house is concerned. On the submarine side of the house, it will never replace the manned systems. That's a bold statement. I think the Navy's already looking at ways in which we can reduce the strain and the operational tempo of the submarine force by having common, routine, mundane tasks that don't necessarily require a manned system to go do it. Can we put an unmanned system out there? Or can we augment a manned system and allow them to deploy a UUV to go accomplish that task? So I think it's actually the culture is willing to accept these unmanned systems right now in the Navy.
Can you you left yourself open on that last one. Can you explain why never in anti-submarine warfare, when one could imagine certain roles where you might want, for example, a series of relatively cheap and dumb UUVs to do area denial in a littoral space that I don't want to send a manned $2 billion attack sub into? Is the never because of capability, or is it because of, at the end of the day, you're talking about a submarine or community?
Yeah, it's not because of capability. The UUVs allow you to get into spaces that you can't get into with a submarine, for sure. You can get into the littorals much more effectively with an unmanned vessel.
or vehicle, and you can get into deeper water with an unmanned vehicle. The community aspect of it, submariner against submariner thinking, the two thinking systems trying to adapt, at this point in time, I think that that's a bridge too far. Maybe in the long term, when we've gotten to the point where we can totally deny the enemy or the peer competitor the battle space. But right now we can't do that because, again, it's a capacity issue and maybe it is a technology issue.
Abba, is there an argument within JESDEF about why don't we just buy more Hawkeye, more naval surveillance, more P3 instead of buying this new thing? Why don't we just get, if the problem is we're wearing down our current systems, why don't we just get more of them? Do you see that kind of argument happening?
Well, so I think 3.2, we need the unmanned system. So first of all, it is inevitable to accept a new technology and keep up with the time. No one's information age. But we are so behind in regard to the unmanned system for military activity. And just have need to learn how to this new system fit into the force structure first. And second consideration is human resource. So the Japanese population is decreasing according to some statistics. So Japanese population is will decrease 6 million in 2025. And the ratio of elderly people over 65 will be 25%, increasing 7%. So JASF has 47,000 personnel. If JASF keep this number of personnel in 2025, so we would be confronted with the difficulty of recruiting as much as increasing 7,800 person in 2025. So we cannot tolerate that kind of number. So if we create a new AWACS troops, AWACS squadron or something like that, so we cannot afford to maintain that kind of troops, squadrons. The third is cost. The cost of new conventional weapon is soaring. So the gaps of the air power between advanced country and the developed nation will be expanded. And especially we are now forging to acquire the S-35. So maybe we cannot get the number of the S-35 we want. So at a time, so we have to fill up the gap of the air power in the future.
Johnny Johnson, fellow FF. Got a question for each of you. So for you, Tom, in regards to U.S. capabilities on the borders, are the Coast Guard forces or border security working closely with the National Guard units that are postured potentially in along the borders and using those capabilities? I know some of those units may have unmanned systems that can augment the security mission that you guys have along the borders or even along some of the coastlines as well. And if you are, Bud, in terms of joint or combined training with U.S. forces on UAS capabilities, you talked about not having a doctrine or not having experience. Have there been opportunities lately or recently where you've been able to train with forces, whether it's in Japan or whether Japanese security forces go somewhere else to receive that kind of training? Is that something that's already ongoing or that can be planned in the future to build your capability for UAS? And then for Rob, is there any work being done on teaming of underwater and air unmanned systems in terms of ISR and teaming those capabilities to create a new type of picture where you can vector in on a target using both systems?
Thanks, Shani. For the UAS systems along the borders, CPP has utilized, I don't want to say as farmed out the predator hours, but they have, other agencies have used some of the predator hours to whether it's forest fires, looking at the surveying of that, or some other state and local agencies. So there has been other agencies' use of those outside of CPP and the Coast Guard. So they work with that. Whether specifically the National Guard, I don't have all the details.
He's asking the inverse is whether CPP has used National Guard resources the way it has in other areas.
I don't have any data on that. As far as the Coast Guard's use of it, they have used some maritime patrol aircraft hours to surveil specific down in the Caribbean. They've used those kind of hours. Some of that has come from the National Air Guard and such.
Thank you for Chris. I did say so. We don't know what is the UAV. So at first, we learned about UAV from the United States military. Then I'm very interested in a joint capability group. UAV's center of excellence. So in located in the Creech Air Force Base. So, but I've never been there. So we have to send. So JAFTA should send a person to that kind of the facility, no, base, center of excellence. Then we get a lot of the knowledge to operate UAV. And after that, so maybe procure the UAV. After the procure the UAV, so we're going to make a training. We're going to a good training with the United States. So I think so.
So I don't know if there's been teaming between the my research hasn't uncovered any direct link between the air systems and the unmanned underwater systems. So, but that is very important. As Dr. Kilcullen brought up, you've got this incredibly complex battle space and littorals. You're talking cyber, air, ground, and the underwater portion. It has to happen. It's probably down the road that will occur. I know we do coordinate between the unmanned underwater systems right now and the unmanned surface systems. It's very simple to just push it right up and see if you can vector and target on that stuff. So I don't think it's a bridge too far. I think the UAVs have to develop a little bit more and be more incorporated into the fleet.
Hi, Jeff. Was this another fellow? My question really is to any of you, but very specifically on the comment that you made, Rob, on the taking it to the fleet, let the fleet figure it out how best to utilize it. And my concern is, you know, if we look at it a technology and warfare type of lens, do we short sheet ourselves of fully utilizing the capacity of any technology that we take forward, whether it be UAS, but very specifically UAS, by allowing the fleet to develop the evolutionary capacity? And if you looked at that as a risk to innovation, revolutionary, obviously not a whole lot of stuff revolutionary technology comes from the fleet, but certainly if you look at it as a fleet doesn't really know how to fully utilize it, maybe organizationally they won't make the best placement of that asset. So just wondering if you'd seen that as a risk.
So I actually had that issue, that problem. We were trying to figure out a way that we can put instead of having divers go down and look at contacts that were identified by a mine hunter, is that a mine or is that not a mine? Why am I doing that now with an unmanned underwater vehicle when in Iraq or in Afghanistan I'm using an unmanned ground vehicle to go up and do my initial surveillance and reconnaissance? And, yeah, they didn't do it right. They totally messed it up. But when the acquisition guys came down and said, look, we've already got this on the shelf technology. We threw it at the fleet. They put it in the wrong place. We helped them guide where it went from the acquisition perspective, said, we think this is where it ought to be. I think that's a role that the big Navy or the big organization has to have. But when the fleet took it and they finally adopted, hey, this is how we're going to use this thing, it took off. And they started using it very similar to the way we use the pack bots and the Talon robots over in Afghanistan. Instead of putting people at risk down on an unknown contact, now we're able to go down and look at it with a camera, with a sonar, get right in close and take a look at it. And they're coming up with a doctrine. They're putting it in the right place. But I think initially they will make that mistake. You just got to work with them and not take your eye off the ball.
I want to
extend that question, though, and link it back to the past two questions. Each of you framed it as a role where the technology could augment what we're doing right now. So I'm thinking of the parallel of interwar years. It's a lot like having a group of Navy officers up here and saying, oh, no, you'll get planes. And they go, yeah, planes are going to be great. We've got them on the battleship. It scouts ahead. It allows us to do our job much better. We are embracing planes. And, of course, that's not the real game change of planes. So when you're looking at these roles, how do you change it from just being taking something new and putting it in old boxes and truly reshaping how you do business, whether it's in undersea environment or whether it's how Japan protects its a challenge to the south in terms of disputed islands or Coast Guard looking at how it does maritime search and rescue? How do you allow the technology to be truly disruptive rather than just augment what we're doing right now?
I'll jump on that one. I agree with you when you brought up earlier that we don't need to necessarily have these systems that go out and augment, but you could actually have area denial or put it in the other perspective. You could go out and put a UUV that autonomously dumps off cheap sensors, or put it on they got these gliders and that can last for up to a year, or the floats that can last up to 5 years on the battery life, and it can just sit there and sense. And then you've taken the entire requirement to have a manned system in that area out. You don't need to have them in there at all. And then you come in with a higher level technology that's got the ability to to prosecute that contact, whether it's a submarine, whether it's a contact that we don't know on the bottom, just put a camera on it or blow it up as if it's a mine, or actually put a submarine out there. That would be a game changer. In the near term, I don't see that it's going to be there in the next 5 years or 10 years. Although I will admit that when Hyman Rickover was given the task of putting nuclear weapon or nuclear power to sea, and he did it in 9 years, which is 4 years less than we've been at war with Afghanistan in Afghanistan right now. So I think that there is an impetus. It's not there right now. There's no requirement. And there's nobody pushing us forward to get us to that level. Maybe if the fiscal environment changes, maybe if there's a peer competitor that comes online, then we'll have that impetus to push us and get us out of the manned systems and try to figure out. That's what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan. We kept getting beaten up by IEDs, and we had to figure out a different way of going in and attacking them. So I think that's kind of what's needed nowadays.
Well, so it's dependent on that, Doctor. And maybe the Ministry of the Defense seems to be interested in a HAL system, high altitude long endurance air vehicle, representing the global hope because of airworthiness issues and the airspace issue. And if we pursue to get strategic information, we need a HAL system, regardless of cost. But we have another choice if we focus on cost effective. And mission requirement. HAL system such as MQ-9 or Hermes will be suitable to get tactical information around the remote island. So you mean you said disputed island, right? But so I think it is very important to build up the distributed common ground system among the allied forces. So before we get the kind of the aircraft. So it depends on the doctrine. We have to study about this one first.
I guess in my initial question, I was kind of looking at it as a totality of the Coast Guard aircraft. But as far as the UAS augmenting versus replacing, you could definitely use the UAS to replace manned aircraft in the ISR-type missions. But you would still need the rotary wing for a lot of the prosecution, whether it's prosecution of a SAR case or prosecution of an LE case. And a lot of times right now it's envisioned that the small UAS on board the cutter would replace the mission of that helicopter employed in the surveillance and reconnaissance mission aspect and reserve the helicopter for exact prosecution. Mm-hmm. So it would replace and augment at the same time.
If Any other questions?
Well, I want to thank three of you for not only doing some great research, but presenting it to this group, showing a lot of the key changes and questions that we'll be wrestling with in the next decades. And we're going to take a break now. There should be cookies out in the hallway. The general spoke about Google's strategy for keeping people going. One of the things, if you do go to the Google cafeteria, is they only serve caffeinated desserts and caffeinated drinks. So it's one of the many ways that they're using food to motivate people, and so we're copying it the same. Go enjoy, and then we'll be back in here in a couple minutes for the last panel.